Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Supreme Court right after this. Well, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our forefathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution these 17 words in Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced into our current practice the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. And they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? If you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons we teach in our Mosaic Law School. It's conducted twice a year here at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. Now, to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package first. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. The Mosaic Law School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, we're talking about the Supreme Court, a publication put out by the MacArthur Institute up in Moline, Illinois. It's called Foundations of Liberty. It comes out twice a month, bi-monthly. Put out by a fellow named James R. Patrick, and you can write to them. It's the East Moline Christian School. It's called the MacArthur Institute now. It used to be called the East Moline Christian School at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois, 61244. James R. Patrick. Their phone number up there is 309-796-1485. Again, that's 309-796-1485. Keep your pen out. If you didn't catch all of that, I'll give it to you again before we quit. We're talking about the Supreme Court and Joe Ferguson, a former representative from Utah, wrote this part of the article in here concerning the Supreme Court, and he divided into seven or eight sections over here. And we've been covering each one of those sections over here that deal with the Supreme Court from his point of view, you know, from his argument. There were two basic arguments that came up, if you'll remember. One was Thomas Jefferson's theory. Thomas Jefferson was one of the founding fathers, writer of the Declaration of Independence, and he said that each one of the three divisions of government would construe and interpret the Constitution for itself. That was his view. John Marshall, his cousin, who was the second Chief Justice, said, no, And we think that the Supreme Court should construe the Constitution for all three branches of government. Now, we have followed the Marshall Plan since 1801. Marshall came onto the Supreme Court, stayed there 34 years. And that's the formula that we use to this day. Now, there have been some major changes that have occurred. The Supreme Court, which is designed, well, the judicial system in general, which is designed to protect each individual citizen from government intrusion into his and her rights, to a Supreme Court that now has become all-pervasive and now sets policy for all three branches of government. Is that good or is that bad? I'm not here to judge. I'm just here to report to you that that's the way the game's being played. Now, the courts still protect the individual rights of citizens. If you have, for instance, in the Rosa Parks case down in Alabama, there's a question that comes up. Do individual citizens, because of their, or in spite of their race, or their politics, or their religion, or their gender, have a right to ride the front of the bus? Now, the Supreme Court came down and said, yep, that's correct. They do. Is the carrying of a weapon, or is the ownership of a weapon, a gun, does it comport as an individual right under the Fifth Amendment? Well, the Supreme Court came back and said, yes, it does. Now, the Supreme Court also makes policy for government. And as a result of that, they construe what the Constitution means, what the Supreme Court determines for that policy of government comes out of the Supreme Court, such as the Nixon tapes. Does Nixon have to turn those tapes over to Congress for an investigation? And then on a governmental level, the answer is yes, he has to turn those over. More recently, we're talking about these prisoners down in Guantanamo Bay. Do they have a right as prisoners down there to come up in American courts, or are they prisoners of war? Those are issues, habeas corpus and things like that. And so we have both governmental and we have personal and individual rights that need to be adjudicated. And so far, as I can tell, the Supreme Court's done a pretty good job of protecting individual rights. In fact, they might have gone overboard. That's what many conservative writers are telling us, that they've gone overboard here on individual rights, and they've endangered the nation. And when it comes to governmental policy or the construction of the Constitution as it relates to the operation of government, the conservatives have said, wait a minute, the Supreme Court's jumped off the deep end here. Well, there's a confusion factor. And if some members of the Supreme Court are violating their oaths of office, doing such damage to the Constitution and jeopardizing the very security of our nation, why is it then that they are not removed from office? And why is the situation not corrected? Well, the first is that the process of impeachment is very cumbersome. It requires a tremendous effort on the part of the citizens. And the second is that too many members of the U.S. Senate who control the power of impeachment are ideologically aligned with the judges who violate the Constitution. And the third is that the confusion on the part of the people regarding the problem and the need for the removal of certain judges. There are at least four general groups of people who negatively impact the possibility of constructive corrective action. Well, why don't we think about that one for a moment? The Constitution puts in a process for amending the Constitution. It's been amended several times. I think there's 26 amendments now. We started with 10. So that means it's been amended 16 times. Over the course of our history, 16 times we have decided that we needed to keep up with modern times, for whatever reason. I use the example of the Volstead Act on alcoholic drinks, or drinking alcohol. And as a result of that, we have made major changes in our Constitution. Now, the Constitution provides for the removal of judges. Called impeachment. if the court has become politicized and the Congress has become politicized, isn't it because the people themselves have become politicized? So if that's the case, then there must be a split in people's thinking. And the split has come down on what we call right and left politics. So when we're talking about things like national health care insurance, there isn't any reason for government to be involved in health care at all, period. But the people have been persuaded, for whatever reason, that national health care insurance is important, and we need it, and we ought to have it. So should we go through the amendment process and put it into our Constitution, make it the fundamental law of the land, or should we take a shortcut and go through the judicial process using the politicization or politicization of Congress and the Supreme Court to accomplish the same goal, but do it in a fast track? Well, big government is the rule of thumb today. This is what everybody is faced with, whether we like it or not. It's this big, all-pervasive government that's going to give us what we want. This is democratization. Our founding fathers formed a republic, and we've turned it into a democracy. Democracy has always been mob rule. It always ends in the destruction of the nation. There are no exceptions to that rule. And now that we have gone down that democratic big government mode, I don't think there's going to be much chance of us turning around and going back. And besides that, government has control of the educational format. And while there may be a few people who are alert to the problem, the broad majority of Americans not only don't know that there's a problem, they don't care. Don't know and they don't care. And people, as a general rule, are interested in what they can get, not what they can give. And they're interested in themselves, not in morality. And George Washington pointed out that morality comes from Scripture. Morality comes from the home, comes from the family, and that without it, government can't function. John Adams pointed out that our Constitution is designed for a moral people. And without morality, our Constitution can't work. So if you're wondering why the Constitution's in trouble, why our country's in trouble, it's because the people themselves have become amoral. And if they're not amoral, then they're immoral. And that's worse than the amoral. Used to be in America, we taught morality in our public schools. When I was a child in public school, some 60 years ago or so, we actually learned morality from the Scripture in our public schools. Today we don't do that. And without that, then we don't have a moral anchor from which our citizenry then can make the Constitution function. Does that mean that it's a dead letter issue, that it's a lost cause? Yes, that's exactly what that means. And the sooner you face reality, then the sooner you're able to prepare for the eventual consequences of it. Now, going back, just think about World War II. When the Germans started off with their war machine in September of 1939, they were prepared for war and nobody else was. And everybody else that wanted to participate had to get ready for it. And they actually didn't get ready for it until about March of 1943. And in March of 1943, both sides were at about the equal level, with the Allies gaining momentum every day. And the Germans were losing momentum every day. So from 1939, 1940, 1941, 1942, looked like the Axis powers had it. And then by March of 1943, now it's up for grabs. So let's start thinking about it in pragmatic terms from the German point of view. If you can't win the war in 1940, 41, and 42 in 3 years, if this war continues on for three more years, are we going to win? And the answer was painfully obvious in 1943 that if this war continues on, the Germans are going to lose. And the Japanese are going to lose. So So, looking at it pragmatically from our perspective here today, if we continue on here in America, like the Roman Empire, the Egyptians, and the Babylonians, and the ancient empires of the past, if we just continue on doing what we're doing right now, what will be the ultimate end to this? And the ultimate end is our destruction. Is it going to happen tomorrow? No. Is it going to happen? Absolutely. Every civilization, every city-state, every empire in the past starts, flourishes, reaches its peak, and then goes into national captivity. It goes into decline, and this decline lasts in some cases for hundreds of years. But the ultimate end is always the same. The average length of an empire or a city-state is about 200 years. America is more than 200 years old. The German Empire, the Third Reich, only lasted for 13 years. Roman Empire lasted for nearly 500. But when you average them out, you know, throughout history, the average length's about 200. America is about 200 years old. We started out in a slave state, in colonies, that then rebelled against their master, gained their freedom, flourished for a long period of time, flowered and made its mark in history, then began a decline about 1950, and has been in decline from that point on. Like it or not, that's where reality's at. So when we look at history as a guide for the future, then we can take a look at where we are on the slide, and we're sliding down what we call in law the slippery slope. We're on the slippery slope. Once you enter the slippery slope, can you stop and then climb back to the top? And the answer is, well, nobody's ever done it yet. I guess in theory it could be done, but it's not very likely to be done. Now, many Americans are taking corrective action. They're taking their children out of public school and educating them at home. They are stopping their practice of the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Many Americans have taken a look at the second plank, which calls for a heavy progressive income tax, and have decided we need to stop doing this. And they've stopped. And these are positive steps. And let's take another look here. The central bank concept, or the central bank idea, which comes from the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. It's exact opposite to just weights and balances and thou shalt not steal that we see that comes from Scripture. That being the case, then we've got this Ten Commandment model, which many Americans are turning back to at the family and individual level, versus the big government, all-pervasive economic policy process, and the ten planks to the Communist Manifesto policy. And I think that'll make a very significant impact at the family level. Is it going to save the nation? I doubt it. I don't think half the people of the country are going to get off of the second, fifth, eighth, and tenth planks to the Communist Manifesto. It would be good for them if they did. It would be good for the nation if they did, but there isn't any indication that that's going to occur. President Obama now is firmly committed to this big government, all-pervasive process, and the new nominee that's coming up indicates his preference, which is to the left, which is in the wrong direction on the Supreme Court. Now, the people that are on the left are probably well-meaning people. I'm not here to criticize. They probably have their view. And the majority view at this moment in time is for national health care insurance. And that's because people want insurance. People believe in insurance. Insurance in law is called limited liability. People the majority of people are firmly persuaded that insurance is good. In fact, I don't know the percentage, but I would guesstimate that nearly 100% of Americans have insurance of some form, or in some form. You have auto insurance, homeowners insurance, fire insurance, health insurance, and then you probably have product liability insurance if you're a manufacturer of something, and so on down the line. I know years ago I used to have lots of insurance policies, paid lots of premium. Now, today I can report to you I don't have any insurance, none. I don't buy any insurance at all. There isn't any need for insurance, if you stop and think about it for a moment. Everybody can't collect on the policy. So you have to have more people losing money paying into insurance than people that are collecting money benefiting from it. It's a Ponzi scheme, is what it is. It's a Ponzi program. And it can't work for everybody. It can only work for a minority, but everybody has to participate in it. Now, as a result of that, it takes tremendous amount of resources from the people, and the people become addicted to it. They begin to believe that it's necessary and imperative. And these people that believe in national health care insurance, from the government's perspective and from the individual's receptive perspective, are probably, you know, well-meaning people. But the ultimate end to that, there's an outcome that comes from it, an ultimate outcome. Everything has a cause and effect relationship. And the ultimate outcome to that is going to be the destruction of the nation. We're already there. There isn't any way to save our economy at this juncture of time. And then on top of that, now they're going to add God only knows how many trillions of dollars of additional expenditure in a national health care program. It reminds me of a guy that's bankrupt and has had his car taken away from him, has been evicted from his house, and he announces to his family that he's going down to the bank to borrow $50,000 to speculate in the stock market. This guy isn't in any position to borrow any money, and we Americans are talking about borrowing more, spending more, and we're already bankrupt. Man, that's insanity. For the rest of you people around the world, we here in the United States have gone berserk. We've gone mad. We can no longer think. We can no longer face reality. We're bankrupt. We cannot pay you all the money that we owe you. It is now way past $150 trillion that we Americans owe to all of you people out there in the world. There isn't any way in the world we can pay that money back. We can't even pay the interest on that money. Now, at this moment in time, we're making the interest payments. But we're not paying these payments with real production. We're paying our payments with more promises to pay in the future. More 3x5 cards that say I owe you on it. That's all. So we're long past any possible remedy for the rest of you people out in the world. Now, that means that all of your labors that you have put into our bonds and our debt and credit instruments over there, as far as you're concerned, is dead, and you're not going to get paid, and that's going to put you into bankruptcy. And so the entire world's going through a chaotic period of bankruptcy, which has been, by all reports, well thought out and well planned to create a new world order, a new world government, which is where we were in Genesis chapter 11 at the Tower of Babel. We've gone full circle. And that has an outcome. That has a result, and it's called the Great Tribulation. And that has an outcome, and that has a result. It's called World War III. And that has an outcome, and that has a result, and it's all bad. And it's all reported in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28, two penal clause chapters. So I thought I'd put that little piece to the puzzle in for you. Now, the general public, you know, in general, lacks understanding of the problem. And most people are occupied with a necessity of making a living, raising children, and coping with life's everyday problems. So it's understandable, then, that constitutional jurisprudence remains a mysterious terrain for most, leaving them confused as to a proper course of remedial action. And why is that? Well, they all went to public school. They've all been dumbed down together. There isn't any reason why you shouldn't know and understand. It's that you don't, and you haven't, and you're not going to, and so therefore the broad majority of people then, this is the base that the conservatives believe. Once we wake them up, they will go out and vote and correct this problem. And it's my conclusion that voting is the problem. It is not the solution to the problem. if you could vote the bad guys out and vote the good guys in the next upcoming election, then you never would have voted the bad guys in the past. If voting were the solution, you wouldn't have a problem, because we've been voting for 230 years. So it should tell us a little something that voting then isn't going to solve that problem. So when at times angered and alerted by rulings handed down by the Supreme Court, the people seldom find a source of accurate information to help them grasp the depth of the problem. That's true. Then they listen to Brian Williams and Katie Couric and Charlie Gibson on the 6 o'clock news, and then they become confused because these news media outlets are controlled by these same big government communist 10-plank model people that we're having the problem with in the Supreme Court and in the Congress. Now, once these people have taken control of the educational system, the Supreme Court, the Congress, and the White House, you and I, the little guys out here on the street, don't have much chance in making any meaningful changes in that process. Now, many, when seeking answers, look to the professionals in the legal field and become even more confused. While capable of accurately assessing the situation if they had the right information, the majority of Americans, in the absence of such information, continue in a state of mesmerized confusion. Mesmerized confusion. I think that's a pretty good way to put that. Many special interest groups agree with the results of certain anti-constitutional rulings. For instance, Roe versus Wade might be a good example. And could not care less what method that the court took in arriving at its rulings. These people are much more result-oriented than they are anything else. In fact, their general philosophy usually exhibits contempt for the Constitution and the democratic process. They consider any malfeasance on the part of the court to be highly insignificant when compared to the results which, according to their ideologies, are desirable. So once we have an ideology in place, then the results justifies the means. And by using this result-oriented philosophy, then it destroys the mechanism by which we arrive at that conclusion. And our Republican form of government, then, is doomed. Doomed. Past tense. Now, the legal profession cannot be expected to sound the warning cry and lead the charge against any dangers to our constitutional republic, because the legal system is the very cause posing the dangers to start with. The enemy, ideologically speaking, has captured the robes of the legal profession. And from the academics and the law schools to the judges of the Supreme Court, the philosophy of judicial activism and revisionism reign supreme, and in some areas supreme and unchallenged. They are highly unlikely to lead or even follow in any movement to correct the errors and excesses of the Supreme Court, since they perceive the actions of the court as being correct. So the activists take a look and say there's no problem because we're getting the results that we desire. We're getting political results from the judicial system. And that's what we want because it's a shortcut to the amendment process. Now, as long as the American people put up with that and they keep voting for the same people, they have become politicized. The Congress is politicized. The White House is politicized. And now the court's politicized. So now we've gone to democracy to solve our problems. Democracy has never solved any problem in any civilization of the past. Democracy is the problem, not the solution. And so every time I listen to the president, I cringe a little bit as he talks about our democracy. Okay. Now, there's an outcome that comes from that. We were warned by our Creator that there was an outcome in Deuteronomy 28, so that's where the outcome is going to lie. It's not going to be pleasant, but that's where it's at. Now, to accept the view of the judicial process that activism and revisionism are desirable or even proper, we must develop an extremely cynical perception. And many lawyers develop this in law school, since the view is regularly taught in the law schools. And that view is, it takes a great deal of self-discipline to renounce a philosophy that some of the most renowned figures in the law, in the world of law, hold, and that produce results that you like. To quote Bickle once more, the sin of cynicism is mortal, because it propagates a self-validating picture of reality. If men are told complacently enough that this is how things are, they will become accustomed to it, and then they will accept it, and in the end, this is how things are going to be. Now, the above speaks volumes about the mindset with which many law students become afflicted, which inverts their perceptions of what is constitutional, and from which many are never able to be healed. Now, our president is a lawyer. Our president is well-schooled from the Harvard Law School, but he's been schooled in activism. He has been schooled and taught and trained to be a communist. He practices communism. To him and from his perspective, that's normal. That's the desired result. That's what we all want. And insurance comes from communism. It does not come from the Ten Commandment model. And so the Ten Commandment model now in American life, in American politics, in American jurisprudence has been abandoned, and we have adopted these 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto are now accepted as being normal. It's the way everything works. You send your children to public school and they learn the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. Nobody identifies them as such. They identify them as democratic. It's the democratic way. Our Federal Reserve System is a part of democracy. Our income tax system is democratic. Our school system comes from democracy. And that's all true. Hang whatever label you want on it. But these principles that we're following, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for free education for all children in public school, it's the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you want to call that democratic, hang to it. But that's where reality's at. And the solution is in educating your children at home to morality from the Ten Commandment perspective, not in sending them to public school and teaching them this all-pervasive big government philosophy. Now, hang on, I got to give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now it's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should all keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour an editorial review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Supreme Court. Now, this is an article put out in Foundations of Liberty. It's a publication put out twice a month here by the MacArthur Institute at 946th Avenue, East Moline, Illinois. Their zip code 61244. Phone number up there is 309-796-1485. Again, that's area code 309-796-1485. Now, they'll send this out to you if you ask for the Supreme Court article or publication. They'll send that to you free. If you want to subscribe, they recommend $25 a year. It's done by donations, so they're not charging a fee. They want you to voluntarily donate, and if you give them $25 a year, they'll put you on the mailing list. I suppose if you gave them $15, they would probably put you on the mailing list, but since they're recommending $25, it probably costs them $25 a year to mail that to you, print it, publish it, handle it, and so on. So if you'd at least pay the costs involved, it would be much appreciated. Now, their objective here is to educate people. And I know a lot of times people write me and they'll say, well, you know, you're a real downer. You just don't have any faith in America. And that's like I mentioned earlier in the program. I said, well, that's like having faith in Germany in 1943. You know, you and I could have been sitting here sipping martinis in a cocktail party in Berlin in 1943, and I mentioned to you that the war isn't going well, and that we failed to win in the first 3 years, and it's unlikely that we're going to win in the next three, and if this war continues on, we're ultimately going to lose. That's where the die is cast. It isn't true because I say so. It's true in spite of what I tell you. Ulysses S. Grant made that same observation concerning the Civil War. He was asked how he viewed the war from his perspective as a general, since the Union was losing all these battles to the Southerners. And he said, the North has a population advantage of about 3-1 over the South. And while it's true that the Southern soldiers are killing Union soldiers at double the rate that the South is being killed, he said in the end the North will win, because every time they kill two of our guys and we kill one of their guys, in the end we win, because when it's all said and done and we've killed the last Southerner, we'll still have half our population left. And he was exactly correct. The South, in order to win, had to knock the North out of the war early on. And they failed to do that. In order for the Germans to win, they had to knock Britain out of the war early on. And they failed to do that. Bottom line. Now, the same thing is true here for the Great American Experiment. We had to maintain our republic, and we failed to do that. It degenerated into a democracy. And once a society degenerates into a democracy, its fate is sealed. Every time in the past, it has always been sealed. You're on the slippery slope and halfway down. You're not going to stop and go back to the top. Now, many lawyers and legal activists of today are the street revolutionaries of yesterday. Their ideologies are in sympathy with those in category B above, and consequently are hostile to the Constitution and to its concepts. Many anti-constitutional rulings of the Supreme Court have resulted in the creation of federal regulatory agencies. And this has, of course, resulted in an unrestrained proliferation of regulations with their inevitable profusion of litigation. This has proved to be a bonanza for the lawyers, of course, and very few lawyers will raise a voice against anti-constitutional rulings that feed this bonanza, no matter how egregious they may be, and what threat they might pose to the legal fabric of our republic. Now, another chilling factor on the inclination of any lawyer to publicly raise a voice against any judge or the judicial system is the fact that he knows that this will likely jeopardize his chances for success the next time he appears before a judge in court. Those who err the most, the judges of the Supreme Court, are at the pinnacle of power, in a position to influence, intimidate, or possibly dominate the majority in the legal profession. And it's highly unlikely, then, that any form of effective resistance to anti-constitutional acts of the Supreme Court will develop from the legal profession or the Supreme Court. Any kind of self-regulation would require morality. Morality comes from education, and these people receive their education under the 10th plank to the manifesto. It's not very likely that you're going to see any manifestation in our public school system or in our colleges and universities that's going to turn the situation around. Is it possible? Well, I guess anything's possible, but realistically, it's never been done before, it isn't being done today, and it's not very likely to be done in the future. And so it reminds me of the old adage, you know, you're on Titanic and somebody just told you there's a 300-foot hole down the side of the ship. Now what? Get off. But it's dark and cold down there on the ocean in little boats. The solution here is to get off. I mean, this is a done deal. And the ship is going to sink. That's the bottom line. And now it's every man for himself. Are you going to save yourself or not? And that's the bottom line. And so here in the United States of America, we find the same thing. Now, when America catches cold, the rest of you people out there get pneumonia. So for Australia, I always tell you people in Australia, take out a map and look north. Just take out a map and look north. You have 20 or 30 million Australians down there. And what you're facing is 1.3 billion Chinese. And the only salvation for you is God Almighty himself. And it's not very likely that God is going to intervene for a bunch of communists in Australia giving him the finger. Now, so, you know, think about that for a minute. And then look at your prospects for the future. You Canadians up there, now take a look at this giant to the south. We owe you a lot of money and you're not going to get paid. And how's that going to fare for you and your economy? Not that you're much better off. You're also practicing communism up there in Canada. And as a result of that, you're going to get a result. Now, the question arises, well, can you save yourself and your family from the ship? You know, there's a greater prospect that individual families can save themselves than that the few families that are in a position to save themselves can save their nation. If in fact we had an educated public that were alerted to the problem and were resigned to correcting it, there might be some hope, but that isn't the case and it isn't going to be the case. And so you can sit here and cheer for the captain and the crew and the people that are bailing the water out of the ship with buckets, but the water's coming in twice as fast as you're bailing it out. And bailing it out is, you know, every bucket full you throw over the side is important, and it's a good move. It's a step in the right direction. But now once we understand that the water is coming in faster than we're bailing it out, what that means is the ship is going to sink in the end, but it's going to take longer to sink than it would be if we didn't bail. And me getting in here and helping you bail isn't going to turn the tide. And so looking at my prospects, I'm saying to myself, looks like I need to get off. line. Now, whether the cause is ideological or pragmatic, it seems that lawyers are more prone than others to accept the pernicious and faulty premise that the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is. Now, many in the legal field are unable or unwilling to make the necessary distinction between the awesome power that judges wield and legitimate authority. All of the above, to the contrary, notwithstanding, it should be noted that there exists a number of lawyers and judges who adhere to the Constitution, to original understanding, and strive to repair the damage done to our Constitution and to prevent further erosion. Judge Robert H. Bork is one of those. He's obviously one of those many. The rejection of his nomination to the Supreme Court was due, as many agree, not to his lack of competence or integrity, but because he excels in both of these areas. The media is decidedly not politically neutral. The media is strongly biased to the left and lends its powerful weight to the continuation of the subversion of our Constitution. Not only will it not raise a cry of alarm at an unconstitutional or an anti-constitutional ruling of the Supreme Court, it is more likely to justify and praise it. Understanding these confusion factors is necessary to understand how a problem of great magnitude can exist, even when there is no cry of alarm and no movement to remedy it by those threatened by it. Understanding these human factors also proves that in many cases popular consensus may be very different from reality. We face the same problem with the Ten Commandment model. Americans are very content with their churches and very content with their religious practices. And they're not about to go back to the Ten Commandments or make any meaningful change. Every Sunday their preacher tells them, give your heart to Jesus and your money to the church and everything's going to be fine. That's not true. It's not accurate. It's not correct. But that's what people believe. There's a poll just taken recently within the last week or so that I saw and I thought was very indicative of this very problem. When asked about the recession, 74% of Americans, that's 3 out of 4 now, believe that the recession will end in 2009. Boys and girls, they don't grasp the significance of the 300-foot hole down the side of the ship. And for the first hour, nobody noticed anything being, you know, all that bad about the Titanic. It's a big, imposing ship, and it's sitting high in the water. But an hour from now, the bow is going to be down to the waterline. And then in another hour and 20 minutes, the ship's going to be on its way to the bottom of the ocean. Now, that's where we're at here. It appears that, you know, at this juncture of time, everything is going to be fine. We hope. You know, we have high hopes. But high hopes aren't necessarily going to save it. In fact, I don't believe it. Now, the legislative powers of the federal government. We now have arrived at the point to make the determination of the legitimate powers of the federal government. All of the foregoing was presented to not only provide foundation for what is legitimate, but more importantly, to establish by the use of proper authority that anything and everything done in the name of the federal government is not legitimately authorized by the Constitution. And we've examined the following myths and found them to be specious. And that is, first of all, that the Constitution is no more than what the Supreme Court at any given time might say that it is. And second, that the legitimate powers of the Supreme Court are unlimited. And three, that any act of the federal government is given legitimacy by an illegitimate ruling of the Supreme Court. There are some who advocate that the passage of time lends legitimacy to an illegitimate ruling of the court or act of the government. Such might acquire the appearance of legitimacy by the passage of time, but this theory has no basis in constitutional law. So now we address the central question, Proposition A, which holds that the federal government is authorized only those powers enumerated in the Constitution, or B, that the federal government may exercise any powers not specifically prohibited by the Constitution to arrive at the correct position of what is and what is not legitimate, and we must focus our examination on the source of all legitimate power, which is the Constitution. Now, where questions exist regarding the extent of the Constitution, we shall examine the writings of the framers, as found in the Federalist Papers, for clarification. For focus at this juncture, there might be some repetition of sources cited above. To not only clarify the extent of the Constitution to limit the government to only those enumerated, but to provide the reasoning behind this limitation, Hamilton said this: "It merits particular attention in this place that the laws of the Confederacy as to the enumerated and legitimate object of its jurisdiction shall become the supreme law of the land, to the observance of which all officers, legislative, executive, and judicial in each state shall be bound by the sanctity of an oath. Thus the legislatures, the courts, and the magistrates of the respective members will be incorporated into the operations of the national government as far as its just and constitutional authority extends, and will be rendered auxiliary to the enforcement of its laws. If we will arbitrarily suppose that the contrary, we may deduce any inference we please from the supposition. For it is certainly possible, by an injudicious exercise of the authorities of the best government that ever was, or ever can be instituted, to provoke and to precipitate the people into the wildest of excesses." That's Federalist Paper number 27. So to clarify the intent of the Constitution regarding the arguments of some that the General Welfare Clause might be construed to give unlimited powers, Hamilton further declared, "Some who have not denied the necessity of the power of taxation have grounded a very fierce attack against the Constitution on the language in which it is defined. It has been urged and echoed that the powers to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay debts, and to provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States amounts to an unlimited commission to exercise every power which may be alleged to be necessary for the common defense or general welfare. No stronger proof could be given of the distress under which these writers labor for objections than their stooping to such a misconstruction of the document itself, and had no other enumeration or definition of the powers of Congress been found in the Constitution than the general expressions just cited, the authors of the objections might have had some color for it. But what would have been thought of as assembly if, attaching themselves to these general expressions and disregarding the specifications which ascertain and limit their import, they had exercised an unlimited power of providing for the common defense and general welfare?" Now, that's a straight repudiation of Judge Roberts' construction in 1936 of the General Welfare Clause in the Butler case. Now, while I'm thinking about it, let me turn over here to the footnotes. Yesterday I gave you this Butler versus United States, cited at 297 U.S. 1. That's 297 U.S. 1, Butler versus U.S. or U.S. v. Butler. That was the one during the New Deal that opened the floodgates. It was the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal, elected in 1932, took office in 1933. President Roosevelt introduced House Joint Resolution 192, remember, took our gold. President Roosevelt introduced communism in a formal way to the United States government. He did it in 1933 through 1939. All of the actions taken by the government in those 6 years, from 33 to 39, were total failures. And Henry Morgenthau said so very plainly. Now, that's the bottom line to the last attempt to remedy the Great Depression by government action. And that's exactly the road that we're on today. We're going to remedy the current depression with government action. It's a proven failure. It hasn't worked in the past. The proven remedy is for government to get out of the economy and let the economy collapse. When the economy collapses, it will be at the bottom. And when it reaches the bottom, then we can start over again. And trying to hold it up just prolongs the agony. Bailing water out of the ship will keep it afloat longer. And if that's what you want, boys and girls, then you're on the right course. In 1922, the actions taken by government were keep your hands off. They did. The Depression reached its bottom in less than a year and started up into the roaring 20s from that point on. Now, that's where that game was played. So you have a successful model in 1922 of less than a year, and you have a failure of 11 years of continual depression from 1933 to 41. Now, if that's what you want, you're on the right track. Hamilton explains very clearly then that the general welfare clause in the Constitution was never intended by the framers to be a general grant of power. And it was never intended to grant powers that were not enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 8, the Commerce Clause. And his logic also was very accurate when he explained that it would not have been reasonable for the framers to have enumerated certain powers and then throw in a clause to empower the federal government to exercise in any and every power imaginable. The Bill of Rights, with its 10 amendments, was incorporated into the Constitution because of the fear by some that the limitations of powers would be misinterpreted, which they were in 1936 by the court. So the very problem that was anticipated by the Founding Fathers did in fact occur in 1936 with the misconstruction of the General Welfare Clause as being an all-power to the federal government. The federal government's intent by the framers was to be limited power. The general power belongs to the states. The limited power belongs to the federal government. Now we have the exact opposite. We have all power to the federal government, limited power to the states. Now, that's a fundamental reversal of the power structure of our constitutional republic. And as a result of that, the question arises, well, are we going to be able to turn it around? The answer is no. No, 1,000 times no. You're not going to turn it around. There isn't anybody out there at the helm that's turning the wheel. Everybody is in favor of national health care insurance. Everybody's in favor of the status quo because everybody's getting something from it. The destruction of America has a profit motive built into it for big business, for the legal system, for the political system, for the banking system. I mean, everybody is raping, robbing, and pillaging at this moment in time. We're cannibalizing ourselves. And as a result of that, it's not very likely that anybody's going to turn the ship of state around at this late date in our history. So that's why I say it's time for you and your family to take affirmative action and make a move. What move you make is your decision. I'm not going to sit here and pontificate, but a move is certainly in order. Well, let's see. Let me give you the name and number here of this Foundations of Liberty again. Telephone number is 309-796-1485. Once more, that's 309-796-1485. All right, you're looking for the article on the Supreme Court. I'm about out of time, so let me give you a final reminder here that you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk in the Law Hour. Website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.